Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. And this is Webster Tarpley speaking from Washington, D.C. Yet another week full of events, some magnificent, but we are rolling along. Let's go first to the Middle East, because the Middle East is actually connected. It is, in many ways, the substance of the U.S. presidential campaign. As I think people know, we have been looking at the possibility of a pro-Trump October surprise of terrorism. And when I say October, this is loosely defined, August, September, October, any of these will certainly be part of the equation if they happen. You'll notice that there is an uptick of terrorism around the world. We've just had Tel Aviv terrorist attacks in Israel. We had the previous week the German police shutting down a group of ISIS psychotic patsies and crazies who were going to be attacking in the city of Dusseldorf, one of the wealthy metropolises of the Ruhr area of Germany and the Rhine. These incidents are coming now, and what we're looking for is, will they coalesce into a classic NATO strategy of tension modeled on Italy, hot autumn 1969, right, which was one of the points where this stuff was tested and essentially succeeded to some extent. Now, the only way to, one of the principal ways, let's put it this way, one of the main ways to defeat Trump is that sane people, right, people who are not hysterical or otherwise mentally troubled, probably can't quite understand the fear that Trump has been able to sow with his constant hysterical references to ISIS, right? The average Republican, again, elderly white person, maybe not too well educated, a certain amount of vindictiveness, maybe they're Calvinists like our friend Reverend Chris Hedges, of course, is a Calvinist himself. It's not limited to reactionary Republicans, but they are very much afraid of ISIS. They actually think that ISIS is hiding under the bed. I guess these are some of the same people who used to think that there was a communist under the bed. So if you want to deal with Trump, if you want to put him away really effectively, you shut down the terror operation which he is using, which he is citing in order to spread the kind of crazy stuff that we see. Now, let's just look at this, right? We have been trying to follow it as best we can. And here's the news from today. All week, the noose of the Kurdish fighters, right, these gallant, capable, brave, dedicated Kurdish fighters, their noose has been tightening around this location, this important road crossroads of Manbij. And Manbij, of course, is located inside the Jarablus or Jarabulus corridor. Again, apologies, the transliteration of Arabic into English or other Western languages is, I guess it's still a work in progress. You have to remember that when you're coming in from Cyrillic or Arabic or Chinese ideograms, Japanese and so forth, there's a multiplicity of spellings available. I think with Gaddafi, it was 20 or 25 different ways to spell Muammar Gaddafi. But now it's Manbij, M-A-N-B-I-J, I guess is the agreed on name of this place. So what we're hearing this morning is that the process of seeing the news, first, the Kurdish forces backed by U.S. air power were within 10 kilometers of the city. They then had the main road into Manh Beach under fire. They were cutting that off. The day after that, Manh Beach was surrounded on three sides. And as of this morning, it looks like Manh Beach is totally surrounded. The Reuters headline of this morning, U.S.-backed forces seize control of the last road into Islamic State-held city of Manh Beach in northern Syria on Friday, completing their encirclement of the main target in a major advance against the militants. And this is not coming from people who are of goodwill. This is coming from evil people. This is coming from the infamous Syrian observatory, right? That Taylor living in southern Britain or whatever he is, conceding now that Manh Beach is on its way to being taken, to being liberated. This is now the SDF, right? The umbrella group over the Kurdish YPG. The SDF had by Thursday advanced to within firing distance of the last main highway into Manh Beach, coming, I guess, from the north. The Islamic State's main bastion in the border area west of the Euphrates. That's a euphemism, Reuters. You know, it's not just a border area and it's not the Manh Beach pocket. It is the Jarablus corridor. It is where Erdogan and Turkish intelligence, MIT, ship in everything that ISIS needs, be it fuel, spare parts, ammunition, new psychotic dupes that can be used as cannon fodder, and the rest of it. So the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights Monitoring Group said the SDF had effectively taken control of the final road into the city early on Friday. There's no road left. They're all cut, says the observatory's director, Rami Abdulrahman, biting his tongue because he knows that this is bad for the people that he would like to see prevail. So we can say now that the Jarablus corridor is in the process of being cut. And once it's cut, believe me, you will see ISIS wither like a tree whose taproot has been severed. It will essentially wither on the vine. Now, there's also then the question of what's next. That was a Reuters dispatch I was reading you. Now we go to Al Monitor, and we go to their interesting journalist, Fehim Taştekin, Turkish. Fehim Taştekin of the Al Monitor is speculating that Afrin, it's the other side. It's the western edge of the Jarablus or Jarabulus corridor. And this seems to be the next target. So his question, his article posted quite recently here, asks, will Afrin be the next Kobani? Now, Kobani was the one a year ago or more, which was actually in the spring of was in the summer of 2013. This goes way back. But the idea is that if you're going to see Manh Beach taken over by the Kurds, which we hope, now this is going to be a matter of days, and then on across the Jarablus corridor to Afrin. And of course, Kobani was the beginning of the process by which the Kurds began seizing control of the border with Turkey, since that's where the ISIS supplies come from. It's so obvious. Why isn't it on the evening news? I guess we can speculate why. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. From Washington, D.C. Now, the background for these moves to cut the ISIS supply line and essentially put them on a road to collapse in the very near future and to deprive them of their logistics, All right. This is always the key to these military operations. President Erdogan, written Erdogan, but Erdogan in Turkish or approximately, had come to Louisville, Kentucky, in order to take part in the funeral of Muhammad Ali, who passed away at the end of last week. And what we seem to see now is that Erdogan wanted to be a major speaker at this funeral, and that this was denied to him, and that he then left. He departed, cut his trip short, and apparently stomped out in a fit of pique. Erdogan, of course, having the same kind of dictatorial, tyrannical mentality that we've seen so much of with the fascist, psychotic Donald Trump. So Erdogan flew off. Looks like the King of Jordan, King Abdullah, had also been in Louisville, and he wanted to speak too, and they also told him that he could not speak. I don't know what he has done. And there's a certain amount of obscurity, right? This process of who gets to speak and who not is opaque. But one of the elements here is that when a foreign head of state, head of government comes in, the U.S. Secret Service assigns them a protection detail, and that was done with Erdogan. And what has now happened for the second time in a row, the second U.S. visit in a row by Erdogan, is that his bodyguards, his guerrillas, okay? Erdogan's personal retinue of retainers and bodyguards, they have gotten into a fist fight, a scuffle with the Secret Service people. You'll remember that infamous occasion when Erdogan went to speak at the Brookings Institution up here near DuPont Circle, Massachusetts Avenue, I think. Something similar happened. And in that occasion, it was even Erdogan's bodyguards getting into fistfights with District of Columbia policemen in uniforms, I think. Yes. So Erdogan, obviously a very, very turbulent, unstable person. And you can look at what Erdogan's doing as a tyrant, as a would-be dictator, as a Caesarist. He wants to have the Erdogan dynasty of the Byzantine Ottoman Empire. He wants it to be the Byzantine Ottoman Erdogan Empire. Not likely. The wheel of history, I think, has gone too far. It was 100 years ago that the main dynasty started to fall, right? 1916 in the First World War, right? And after that, there were only the four, you know, diamonds, hearts, clubs, spades, and England. And that was it. So all these monarchies, I think, are on their last legs. And Erdogan's attempt to recreate one, I think, is mal à propos. But he's trying anyway. So here's what's happening. The Jarabulus corridor is being cut. And that looks really bad for Erdogan, and also from the it looks really, really bad for Trump and for Erdogan as well. So the idea now is, you'll remember that whenever the terror attack, Erdogan says, oh, this is terrorism and the Kurds, not only the PKK, but also the YPG, says Erdogan, those are all terrorist organizations. So this is extremely interesting. And the sense of the two parallel lives, right? Trump would be dictator, Erdogan dictator, having gotten rather farther down the road in his country than Trump has over here. But how all of this fits together. So Syrian Democratic Forces, including the YPG Kurds, and it includes the women, and it was the female units of the YPG. They have captured the admiration of the world for what they're doing once again in regard to this town of Manbij. And what it shows is that if we had politically motivated, dedicated people, ISIS is a paper tiger. ISIS can essentially be wiped out. And that's what we're hoping is going to happen, because it's obviously, it's imperative to do this in itself, but it also then gives you this benefit that you cut the demagogue Trump off at the knees if he's got nothing to complain about. Remember, Hitler's main theme for the first, 10 years, maybe more, almost 15 years of his demagogic career, his main theme was the stab in the back, die Dolchstoßlegende, meaning the German army had not been defeated in the field, but had been betrayed by politicians in Berlin, be they liberals, be they Jews, be they communists, be they other of other types. That was Hitler's main theme. And, of course, that the Versailles Treaty with the war guilt clause, giving Germany the total guilt that this was wrong and that reparations were unjust. Well, Lord Keynes had pointed to the unworkability of this reparation scheme, at the conference, essentially, right? In real time. So Trump has got to have grievances, right? Crippled America is his theme. Pessimistic. He just gave a speech here to a bunch of Christian reactionaries, holy rollers, where he says, oh, I'm so optimistic. Yeah, you're so optimistic that you call it crippled America. You're fooling nobody. The idea is he needs that because that's the grievance. He's got to say the grievance. He's got to show that the military and the country has been betrayed by the stupid officials who have been doing the wrong trade deals, where, of course, he's going to do only great, fantastic trade deals. What is the difference? Well, he'll tell you. Give him power, he says, and then right, make me dictator, and then I'll show you. Sorry. So now look, the Democratic, getting back to the domestic side, and we'll be getting to the domestic side here in just a minute on World Crisis Radio. I want to try to describe some proposals that we have to try to help Bernie Sanders to get as much permanent benefit for the American people out of his campaign, right, and the undoubted partial successes, at least, that he's had. But let's focus, first of all, on the psychotic fascist, or, if you will, the fascist psychotic. That's the choice, right? You don't have to call him a psychotic fascist. You can call him a fascist psychotic. And who are we talking about? Of course, the orange man, Don of Orange, and that's Donald Trump. Now, here's a publication called Accuracy in Media, and it used to be Reed Irvine, and I think it's still sort of in the family, but they have Cliff Kincaid, who has been working there for quite a few years, and these, of course, are the traditional reactionaries. And it's interesting from time to time to see how they view the world. So you'll remember that I was fortunate enough to be able to give a presentation on Trump, both from the fascist point of view and from the psychotic point of view. And we have 10 or 12 ways in which Trump is a fascist, and then we have about 10 different psychological maladies, and that's 10 and counting. And we're going to get another one coming in today. But let's first of all look at what I hope I can regard as a kind of spinoff, right? It's an echo of what I had to say at the Left Forum, John Jay College, New York City, back on May 21st. So this is called Trump as Seen as a Vehicle to Destroy GOP. So this is Accuracy in Media, written by Cliff Kincaid. The date on this is June 10th. And let me just read you a couple of samples. while showing an image of Donald Trump as a wrecking ball, veteran leftist operative Webster Tarpley told the recent Left Forum in New York City, quote, "If we play this right, we can destroy the Republican Party." These comments, delivered at the major left-wing gathering of the year, reflect the belief among progressive in quotes, activists that the Donald J. Trump candidacy can be used to destroy the Republican Party and usher in a major period of Democratic Party rule. It's, of course, ruled by two Democratic parties soon fighting among themselves. I don't think he quite got the part about, you know, wreck the Republicans, split the Dems, although he does quote it. A major period of Democratic Party rule under the increasing influence of an openly socialist faction. Now, I don't know where you get that. This is pure Alexander Hamilton, Abraham Lincoln, Justin Morrill, Franklin D. Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy. This is the American system of Henry Clay, of Hamilton, and so forth. Anyway, quote, "This party must be destroyed," said Tarpley, referring to the Republicans. Tarpley's analysis of the political scene takes on additional significance as we see evidence of communists and Mexican nationals protesting outside Trump rallies. Ay, 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 ay. So this is at the Left Forum. He's got some kind words about me. I can't resist. A former operative in the movement led by Lyndon H. LaRouche, an aging Marxist ideologue who served time in prison on fraud charges. Yes, he did. I didn't. Tarpley is viewed by the left as an expert on the class struggle that defines the evolution of the American political system. This is simply the, in large part, it is the V.O. Key theory of critical elections, watershed elections, and party realignments, right? That we've been through six or seven party systems. So, drawing on historical sources and stories about turmoil in the Trump campaign and the GOP, Tarpley predicted that Trump's candidacy will divide the Republicans and result in one of its factions merely surviving as a regional party based in the Deep South, rural areas, and the Intermountain West. However, he said the party itself has become so dependent on aging white men, a shrinking percentage of the electorate, that it may be doomed in the long run. Tarpley thinks Sanders has not gone far enough to the left, believes opposing Trump and calling him a fascist is a smart organizing tactic for the left. So remember, I had two things. One was that the GOP is doomed. Another one is focusing on Trump. So Tarpley's talk was called "Destroy the GOP, Split the Dems." Tarpley describes the Sanders campaign and associated groups as New Deal Democrats, more or less, aspiring at least, as opposed to the Wall Street Democrats backing Hillary Clinton. Eventually, if everything goes according to plan, the Sanders wing of the Democratic Party will take control in a progressive realignment, and a new progressive coalition could emerge and dominate American politics for decades. Trump is the trigger for this dramatic series of developments, Tarpley told the leftist conference, which means the Republican Party could go extinct, since it's perceived as being hostile to the new immigrants who have flooded into the country. He's predicting a complete political realignment for the period 2016 to 2046. Well, the political realignment has started with Obama 2008. It has taken a modest step forward inadequately in Obama 2012. And now we have to put this away. In other words, we've got to see, well, what he talks about here, quoting me, is that the Republicans would be going the way of the Federalists, the Whigs, and the Know-Nothings. And, of course, the Know-Nothings, that's Trump. How many times have you heard those Trump spokespeople on cable TV saying, "I don't know. I don't know who David Duke is. I don't know who any of that is." Here you go. While the demise of the Republican Party may seem like wishful thinking, Tarpley outlined a political scenario that is plausible to outside experts. Hey, and which could mean that the GOP would meet the fate of other political parties in American history, such as the Federalists, Whigs, and Know-Nothings, by breaking apart, losing the presidency, Congress, and Supreme Court in the process. Right? And Tarpley's predictions came just a few weeks before Trump unleashed his series of attacks on the, quote, Mexican judge. So they've followed me here to various things that I've done in Europe. Do take a look. So it's by Cliff Kincaid. The publication is called Accuracy in Media, AIM.org. And here we see Trump as this vehicle to complete the destruction of the Republican Party as a national political force. It would still be available for racists, bigots, reactionaries, malcontents, the disgruntled, and so forth in those areas. Deep South, rural, Intermountain West. I would, we should also, in fairness to Trump, we should add also what we've seen now in the, these Northeast primaries, right? On the same day as New York, from Maryland to New York to Rhode Island, right? There's an Archie Bunker, force, right? So you might say in certain suburbs, the Archie Bunkers, right? This sort of cultural backlash, reactionaries, they might play a large role. So anyway, take a look at Accuracy in Media, and that, it will, secure, I hope, a broad, audience for what I was trying to do, right? And we have some evidence that it's already happening. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So, again, reviewed a very interesting article, Big Attack on My Appearances There at the Left Forum back on May 21st. And this is located, I guess, in the it ascribes a kind of prophetic power to what I'm saying. It's not so hard because, remember, the essence of psychosis in particular is repetition. Creativity, the free faculty of creativity with the preconscious working, that creates new things. But if you're stuck in the area of extreme neurosis or psychosis, then it's just repetitive. And this is what applies to Trump. But in the meantime, I would like to, again, express my, my gratitude for the recognition coming from this Accuracy in Media that I'm an expert in class struggle, that I am regarded on the left as an expert in class struggle. Tarpley is viewed by the left as an expert on the class struggle that defines the evolution of the American political system. Well, that's not exactly the way I would put it, but we'll take it, especially because we want to avoid and we did this in our daily briefing a little while ago. You have the question of class struggle. Class struggle, not in Marxist terms, not, but in terms of Plato and Machiavelli. And that is the people against the oligarchy. The people against the oligarchy, and that is the secret of the modern state. The modern state requires a kind of conflict, a juxtaposition of the people, middle class, against oligarchs, right? The plutocracy, right? And that is certainly very much to the point. So Machiavelli says it, Plato had said it. So this is not Marx, and even the groups are not the ones that Marx pretends to identify. But these are the ones, again, from a political tradition which is much older, right, going back to the around, you know, 1520, or then back to Plato in Athens. So that's one thing. Now, today on the Diane Rehm Show, in the domestic hour, what did we hear? Edward Luce, L-U-C-E, Edward Luce of the London Financial Times goes through a psychological discussion of Donald Trump. And I think this is a first. So this is now what? 3 weeks after my speech at the John Jay College for the Left Forum. And you can hear this if you want to go to the Diane Rehm show. It's on there as a tape. I think they do transcripts, so it will be on there as a transcript. At about the 45-minute mark in the domestic hour, the first hour, the 10 to 11 a.m. Friday morning hour, Edward Luce of the Financial Times says, Donald Trump exhibits the signs of a narcissistic personality disorder. And he points out that there is a problem in getting this analysis to the public, which is that the psychiatrists, psychologists, and psychoanalysts have what I regard as a crippling ethical maxim that they all seem to agree on, which is that you're not supposed to psychoanalyze somebody at a distance. Now, remember, Dr. Justin Frank, a dozen years ago, when it came time to, to answer the question, should Bush, the younger George W., be reelected to a second term? Dr. Justin Frank, thank God, came out with Bush on the Couch, showing that Bush, George W., was a megalomaniac. And in this case, that was fine, although that violated the ethics of this profession. And then the other side is, if Trump has gone to somebody for psychiatric help, then they're bound by confidentiality. And we do know that Trump has gone to a shrink, to a psychologist, psychoanalyst, because Trump has offered the diagnosis of himself. He's volunteered this in interviews, that he has what he calls a borderline obsessive compulsive disorder. And this is the stuff about not wanting to shake hands, being afraid of germs, watch out for teachers, and so forth. So in this case, though, Edward Luce of the Financial Times, a rather influential publication, says on the radio here that Trump has narcissistic personality disorder. Narcissistic personality disorder, NPD. That Trump has certain instincts, and that he has psychological waywardness. And psychological waywardness is compounded by no empathy, a lack of empathy about the emotional situations of others, and that Trump is incapable of accepting objective advice, good advice, and acting on it. He can't do it. Now, that's already highly interesting, because remember, narcissistic personality disorder, NPD, is one of, I think it's the second one, that I have gone through and discussed myself in that speech at John Jay College on May 21st in New York City. But now let's also look at another, participant in this discussion. He's mentioned, today by Edward Luce of the Financial Times. Now, this is David Brooks, liberal Republican at the New York Times. So, the idea here is you can't be friends with Donald Trump. He's not a team player. You can't be on the team with Donald Trump. Donald Trump will never join your team because he is always marching to the tune of his internal psychosis, I would say, whatever one, his psychopathology on the inside. Remember, there were discussions in the 9/11 era, right? If the problem of having all these paranoid schizophrenics like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Mousawi, right? Zacharias Mousawi. Zacharias Mousawi was, by definition of his own legal team, a psychotic. In other words, a paranoid schizophrenic. And the problem of such people is they can't work together. This is one of the limits of this entire theory, right? In other words, if you have certain kind of psychotic, they can't get along with each other. It's not like you'd think that they would be good friends because they share the same psychosis. No, 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 no. The psychosis means that they can't cooperate. So let's listen to David Brooks here. He wants to warn the Republicans, you can't unify around Donald Trump for the same reason you can't unify around a tornado on the ground, right? He has to undermine and negate cooperation, reciprocity, solidarity, stability, unity. He is a lone wolf. He's a solitary figure, a disloyal diva, incapable of horizontal relationships. I don't know. I think he's had quite a few, maybe too many horizontal relationships, but you get the idea. Anybody who tried to be nice to him, from Christie to Ryan, he has kicked them in the teeth. That's his thanks. So, some conservatives believe they can educate, convert, or civilize Trump. That's what von Papen thought about Hitler. That's what Hugenberg thought about Hitler. That's what von Schleicher talked about Hitler. And of those, one dead, one narrowly escaped death, and another one a dead soul. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to the Sex Hour, World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarplier in Washington, D.C. It is June 10th, 2016, as we're recording. So, this is your resident expert on class struggle. And you can read all about that in Accuracy in Media. I was then struck this morning that the New York, the U.S. correspondent of the London Financial Times, YD Red, that is Edward Luce, repeated on the Diane Rehm show on National Public Radio. I think he said narcissistic personality disorder twice, or maybe three times, that Trump suffers from psychological waywardness. He has no empathy, no interest in the emotional life of anybody else. Self-centered. He has no empathy, and he can't take objective advice. So those are his instincts. Now, it also mentioned in this account is the article this morning, that is to say, the 10th of June, in the New York Times, where David Brooks, the liberal Republican, with all the problems that that means. Remember, we're obviously looking at evil fighting evil. We want evil to fight evil. We don't want evil to cooperate with evil against the forces of human civilization. We want the evil ones fighting each other. This is the main point. And right now, the most malignant, right, aggressive, militant form of evil is, of course, fascism. And that's Trump. In order to be a fascist, you have to have a mass movement with violent tendencies. Who has that? There's only one who has that. It's Trump. Don't tell me about these other candidates. They don't have fascist mass movements. Mrs. Clinton is a laughingstock. She can't fill a room with 100 people. No fascist movement, no mass movement of any kind there. But Trump, oh, well, Trump certainly can. Bernie may have some masses from time to time, but they're not militant in that sense, right? There are militant people, but they don't come from Bernie, believe me. Bernie is, he's afraid of his own shadow in some of these areas. Okay, so according to David Brooks, New York Times this morning, some conservatives believe they can educate, convert, or civilize Trump. This belief is a sign of both intellectual arrogance and psychological naivete. I did a whole write-up this week on the Tax Wall Street Party morning briefing. Here we go. Gingrich, Ryan, Corker, Perry, Priebus, and other GOP political hacks are climbing on the Trump bandwagon. They should recall the sad fates of establishment reactionaries, so-called conservatives, reactionaries, in Germany who tried to ride Hitler's coattails in a coalition cabinet. Von Papen narrowly escaped assassination. A lot of his staff was just killed, mowed down, shot at their desks. Von Schleicher, general, former chancellor, came to the door. He was assassinated, and his wife. And Hugenberg, huge power in the Krupp industrial empire, big guy among the East Elbian Latifundist, right? The Junker class out there east of the Elbe, right? In what is today Poland, he was essentially made into a non-person. So the Knight of the Long Knives. And it's, you can see it's rooted in the psychology in both of these cases. Now, back to David Brooks. The man who has just crushed those conservatives is in no mood to submit to them. Furthermore, Trump's personality is pathological. It is driven by deep inner compulsions that defy friendly advice, political interest, and common sense. It's obvious that Brooks is doing what I urged such people to do. Consult with professionals. If they want to be anonymous, let them be. But get this analysis out there where the public can see it. So here we are in the university, the newspaper of record. And from there, it goes to all kinds of other publications, gets on TV. Obviously, you want to tune into the Blab shows on Sunday. C-SPAN radio from noon to five, right? You can hear all five of them. But back to David Brooks again. It is useful to go back and read the Trump profiles in Vanity Fair and other publications from the 80s and 90s. He has always behaved exactly as he does now. The constant flow of insults, the endless bragging, the casual cruelty, the need to destroy allies and hug the spotlight. Quote, Donald was the child who would throw the cake at birthday parties, his brother Robert once said. Psychologists are not supposed to diagnose candidates from afar. I would say they have to. The national emergency overrides that formalism, which is impotent. There is a well-developed literature on narcissism that tracks with what we have seen of Trump. By one theory, one theory of narcissism says that it comes from a developmental disorder called alexithymia. Alexithymia, here's a new word, people. A-L-E-X-I-T-H-Y-M-I-A. Alexithymia, meaning essentially no words for emotions, right? So it is the inability to identify one's own feelings. So the inability to identify and describe emotions in one's self, in the self. Sufferers of this have no inner voice to understand their own feelings and to reflect honestly on their own actions. Unable to know themselves, the person afflicted with alexithymia, they cannot truly love themselves. They can't have any normal, healthy self-esteem, which is based on, obviously, accomplishments. Do good things, get some praise, and have self-esteem. Perfectly good, necessary. These people cannot know themselves. They cannot love themselves in that sense. They can't hold themselves in high regard. They hunger for a never-ending supply of admiration from outside. They act at all times like they are performing before a crowd and cannot rest until they are in the spotlight. To make decisions, these narcissists create a rigid set of external standards, often based around admiration and contempt. Their valuing criteria are based on simple divisions, winners and losers, victory or humiliation. They're preoccupied with luxury. Everything around them has to telegraph that they're wealthy, that they're beautiful, handsome, powerful, successful. They take the usual notions of charity or social solidarity or tzedakah in Judaism, and they simply invert them. They're incapable of understanding themselves. They have no empathy for others. They don't know what it's like to walk in somebody else's shoes. Other people are simply suppliers of admiration, or then when they have to devalue them, victims to be crushed as part of some dominance display. So they go out daily in search of enemies to insult and friends to degrade. Trump reportedly sets members of his campaign staff against each other, right? We have that this week, that the Manafort clique, which is sitting in offices in New York and Washington, Manafort's clique, the torturers' lobby, are always fighting with Corey Lewandowski and Ms. Hicks, the press staff. Each person is up one day, down another, always wondering whether they'll be in favor, out of favor, and so forth. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C., your resident expert on class struggle. So we have very interesting developments, right, that the National Public Radio audience and the New York Times readers are seeing now. Trump as psychopathology. This David Brooks piece is called The Unity Illusion, June 10th, today. And it means that you can't cooperate with him, even if you want to, even if you try to. He won't accept it. He's always got to devalue you. He's got to turn against you and in public and make you grovel. And down you go. So, on his staff, he's playing one clique against another. Easy. Everybody wants to know, you know, what's my standing today? So they're waiting for the Sun King, Le Roi Soleil, Louis the 14th. And that's also Trump's favorite decorating style, right? This Mar-a-Lago has got some pretty grotesque Trumpery, right? Some trompe d'oeil in terms of Louis the 14th, right? Louis XIV. That's going to be the court furniture. So the Sun King is deciding whether you're up or down. These various bourgeois hacks, like Ryan and Mitch McConnell, even maybe more pathetic, they can try to cooperate with Trump, be loyal to Trump, but he won't be loyal to them. They have to run, says Brooks here, they have to run their own separate campaigns. Donald Trump does not share. He can't share because he's totally focused on himself. And it's a hollow ego. It's, again, a very harsh and brutal superego that doesn't say to him, you know, you need to advance the cause of your country or your religion or anything positive. Civilization, any of those would be fine. But no, he can't do that. He's got to be the guy who essentially is told by his superego, you've got to essentially be brutal. You've got to smash everybody else. And there's no way except, to be cruel and, if necessary, certainly violent in terms of verbiage and then often actually in terms of violence. Okay. So it seems to me then that this is the promising way. The only way to deal with Trump, the only way, is psychotic fascist, fascist psychotic. All this other stuff we've seen this week from various Democratic Party candidates and surrogates and staffers, it's sometimes okay as far as it goes. Sometimes it will resonate with certain groups that they're talking to, but it's not going to be adequate. Pardon me. The pollen out here in Washington is, you go to your car and you've got a layer of yellow powder over the windshield that you have to somehow dust off. So You get the idea. Now, let's also look at another interesting complication of this. The Trump campaign, most media sources that I have been able to monitor agree now that Trump has virtually no cash on hand, He has virtually no staff. He's got a staff of about 75 people, seems to be the consensus estimate. He has very little money, even compared to Hillary Clinton. He has no fundraising activities going on. He doesn't do large-scale fundraisers, right? The $25,000 a plate things, right? He did one for Christie, but that was for Christie. That was the Lawrenceville one. But he doesn't do fundraisers. Yesterday, he met with a group of Republican money bags. But the problem there is a lot of them don't want to be known in public. They don't want their names mentioned as people who are financing Trump. And they may be able to keep this hidden or not. But the idea is if you're a businessman and you're going to go out and say, I'm giving big money to Trump, you're going to be boycotted. And so it should be. The tool of the boycott must be used to punish these characters for their contempt for the constitutional system that we're fortunate enough to still have in this country. So no cash, no staff. The idea now is Manafort came up with a list of business women who like Trump. And this was in California for the most recent primary. So Manafort had recruited a bunch of fairly well-known businesswomen, and they were supposed to have a series of events across the state of California, except that there had to be a press release to go out and announce this fact. And Corey Lewandowski, right, the guy who beats up women, and this poor, isolated Miss Hicks, the two of them blocked every version of the press release. So eventually there was never anything. No events were scheduled, nor did any apparently ever take place of the businesswomen, for Trump. There's no ground operation. Remember, Trump in most of these caucus states, especially, but also in the other states, he always underperformed the polling because people just didn't go out and vote. And that's the kind of voter he has, right? These are people who are not political. They've never been political. They're not likely to start now. For them, voting is already a lot, right? But, you know, they're not going to go and work on phone banks and things like that. He's going to have to pay for that. But how can he pay? He's not fundraising. And, of course, the idea that Trump was self-funding was a big lie, a huge lie. How these corrupt, dastardly, wretched, despicable media hacks ever allowed him to get away with that? He lent money to his campaign, but he wants it back. And it was not that much money anyway, right? We're told what he said today in his speech here to the Holy Rollers, that he spent $55 million of his own money. Yeah, I'll believe that when I see it. I don't believe that because again, these are loans. He's not self-funding. He wants to get that back. Notice also, he would never have given the $1 million to the veterans if the Washington Post hadn't slammed him and forced him. And that's why he was so irritated when he had to fork over that money. He's a guy, he's a Welsher, put it that way. He Welshes on all his debts. And the more defenseless you are and the more vulnerable you are, the happier he is to stick it to you as a Welsher. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So the Trump campaign, a logistical disaster. Now, again, he is a miser. He wants to hoard money. He doesn't pay. We've now got various journalists have gone around and collected people suing Trump for non-payment on their invoices, right? This includes plumbers, cleaning ladies, waiters, busboys. It includes lawyers. It includes a whole cross-section of people. And the common denominator is Trump says, I'll give you 100,000 and you're lucky if you get 75. And what's the difference? He's going to say, oh, I didn't like what you did. I didn't like the quality. He doesn't call you up and say, this is inadequate. Please come over and finish it up for me. And then you're going to get paid the full negotiated amount. No, 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 no. Trump is there to say later, right? A year later, 2 years later, that he, didn't like what you did. So we have family businesses that have been destroyed by this disgusting predatory parasite, a Wall Street insider, if there ever was one. So, but why, again, is there something deeper? Interesting thing that maybe is not widely known, the Nazi theory of the Blitzkrieg, the lightning war, la guerre brusque, as it was called already in the 1920s, the quick war, lightning war. This reflected, I think, it's a kind of a tendency of fascist thinking that you can see in Trump as well. The idea is that you don't want to have logistics in depth. You don't want to have a comprehensive, productive base that you can mobilize for your military operations. It's all done on the basis of what we would call shock and awe. So it's all the blitz, the lightning war, the enemy collapses within a few weeks, right? France, 6 weeks, Poland, 6 weeks, other countries, right? Denmark, one day. So that's blitzkrieg, and that works fine until it doesn't. And again, when you do the political equivalent of invading Russia, Soviet Union, then your blitzkrieg is not going to stay on the timetable you think. So don't kid yourself. So this is what he does. Now, it's interesting, in the history of the Nazi regime, it is clear that Hitler did not, and the Nazis did not mobilize the full productive capacity of the German economy until the war was already lost. In other words, until von Paulus had been defeated at Stalingrad in the winter of 1942 to 1943, it's only in, what, February, March of 1943 that we get the famous sports stadium speech by Goebbels, right? Sportpalast, Goebbels, and this is Goebbels turning to the big crowd saying, do you want total war, right? Wollt ihr den totalen Krieg? And, of course, they do because they're all shills that have been handpicked by Goebbels to be there and essentially a group of yes-men. But that's interesting, isn't it, that the Nazis, even, you know, by this time, Hitler had gone into the Soviet Union on June 22nd, 1941, and all of 41 and all of 42, and you get into the spring, or late winter at least, of 1943. It's only then that the Nazi economy is subjected to this total war mobilization, and according to some, they don't reach full mobilization until 1944 when Europe is already being invaded. So there's a kind of resistance. And some people say, well, Hitler was afraid that if he went for total war, there would be shortages of consumer goods and that would undermine his popularity. Maybe in the case of Trump, there's something like this working. But the point is he doesn't want to spend his own money. He won't do the fundraisers that it really are the only other way. He tries to talk to these bigwigs in private, and that doesn't work so well. Now, we just ought to look at the people who are not supporting him, right? We had the first de-endorsement coming from Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois. Mark Kirk of Illinois thought to be the most endangered of all the incumbents this time. Kirk flailing wildly trying to get away from Trump. Senator Flake of Arizona is also not supporting Trump. Senator Collins of Maine says that she's considering voting for Hillary Clinton. We have Governor Hogan here in Maryland, who has said many times that he doesn't want to have anything to do with Trump, that he doesn't like him. This is a guy who is the great friend of Chris Christie. So Hogan just says, you know, I'm not going to be talking about him at all, right? The idea is what I got out of this press conference by Hogan the other day was I haven't endorsed him and I won't. Now, Kasich, this is really important. Ohio, okay? Ohio, the Republican, right? Historically, the Republican has to win Ohio, has to. And Trump especially, because Trump now has no hope in Florida, no hope with all those Hispanics, all those Latinos. Even the reactionary Cubans are having a hard time with Trump. So that leaves Ohio. Kasich has this machine. That machine came out and allowed Kasich to win the Ohio primary. Kasich is not supporting Trump. This is really, really something. And this, of course, comes after all the Curiel stuff. Trump on Monday is going to launch a diatribe, a philippic, against Hillary Clinton and all of her corruption. Right? Do you renounce Hillary Clinton and all of her works? Right? So that's Trump. Notice, Trump doesn't really have, now that he's gotten into this dust-up with Newt Gingrich and Senator Corker, which were the only ones he had, he doesn't have any high-profile, well-known surrogates who are willing to stand up for him. Whereas on the other side, we've got Hillary. We've got former President Bill Clinton. We've got Obama. We've got Biden. We've got Senator Warren, all attacking Trump and soon probably Bernie. And we'll try to talk about Bernie here to the extent we can. Bernie has been treated very badly. But a lot of this, again, is his own fault. What was done on Monday evening, right, that the Associated Press came out on Monday, the day before the California primary, saying, oh, we just talked to several of the superdelegates and they have switched over to Hillary Clinton, so we think she's now gone over the top with magic numbers. This is outrageous. I don't know how you can ban this under the First Amendment, but a boycott. The Associated Press, of course, is shot through with intelligence community people. NBC soon followed. And then all the rest of them, not one of them, bucked on this. So these were secret phone calls. There's no transcript. There's no accountability. There's no way to verify this. Secret phone calls to unnamed superdelegates where they say off the record that they're switching. There's no list of names. There's nothing. There's just the AP saying, oh, by the way, we've made these phone calls and these people have all switched over to Hillary, so she is now the winner. Outrageous. Now, the problem, though, is we're getting all these reports, right, that Bernie was robbed. Well, we tried to do that. The Tax Wall Street Party tried to save Bernie in Iowa. We put out a nice press release. Bernie wouldn't lift a finger, and that's been the rule all the way. Bernie won't fight. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. We're left now with these reports that Bernie Sanders has been robbed of the election in New York State, and we did it ourselves in Iowa. The problem with all this is Bernie Sanders does not come out in public and give a press conference and make these accusations himself. And if he won't do that, the accusations take on no life of their own. They're essentially hearsay or court papers. That is impotent. That's cowardice. I'm sorry. If you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. If you're going to take money from people and say, I'm running for president, then do it. And that means fight for your vote. Defend the right of your voters to have their vote counted. And if you don't do that, you're an independent, you're fussy, you're impotent. Now, nevertheless, we don't give up on Bernie because for the sake of his followers, really, what should he do now? Well, I think essentially the following, right? The television coverage portrays the end of the primaries, at least, right? District of Columbia coming next Tuesday, and Bernie, quite properly campaigning around here in the District of Columbia for that. They portray this as an emotional experience for Bernie. In other words, how humiliated is he? How wounded is he? How has his pride been scratched up and so forth? Forget all this. Subjectivity. We don't care about the subjectivity. We want objective reforms. We want pledges that are going to mean something. The first thing for Bernie, I would say, is show your bona fides. In Vermont, the rap on Bernie is that he's been there for decades. He has never built an independent political revolutionary organization, or whatever he wants to call it, outside of the Democratic Party. There is no organizing with Bernie, right? Even Obama did this. It was called Organizing for America, and it still exists, I think. At the beginning, it looked quite formidable. Actually, it looked so formidable, it was a little bit scary. But that was the Organizing for America. Bernie should have something, you know, organizing for social justice or economic justice. He should pledge to make that organization permanent, give it a life of its own, make it self-governing, not just an extension of him, not an extension of the Democratic Party, nor of the Bernie campaign, but something permanent. It could be a nationwide membership organization, the first since Students for a Democratic Society, self-destructed under the FBI, CIA, weathermen back in 68 to 69. Now, on the question of war and peace, the big problem with Hillary Clinton, as we know, is that she's a warmonger. She's a militarist, right? A lot of people talking about this. A lot of Bernie people saying they're not going to support her because she's a warmonger. Well, why not do something along these lines? Force Hillary Clinton, reading the construction of the Constitution, according to which you cannot undertake military action in a foreign country without a declaration of war from the Congress. In other words, a very strict construction on war to try to box her in and prevent her from doing these things. The only exception would be if you're under direct attack. In other words, if some ICBM is already in the air on its way to you, that's different. But anything else like this, right? That she also be encouraged to include, she should make a statement saying, color revolutions and regime change are forms of aggression and warfare in the 21st century, and they have to also be covered, they have to be preceded by a declaration of war by the Congress. Make her put that in writing, sign it, proclaim it, read it out, that she's not going to be able to wage war according to her own wretched psychological needs. Now, the next one is 1% Wall Street sales tax. Bernie, in the course of his campaign, talked about a Rebuilding America Act. The Rebuilding America Act for Bernie was $1 trillion that would create 13 million jobs over 5 years. That's wretched. That's too little, too late. What good is that? First of all, don't take the money from the U.S. Treasury. You can do better with the Federal Reserve. In other words, you should be demanding if it's going to be $1 trillion, get your trillion as 0% 100-year credit from the Federal Reserve and use that to begin pilot project, opening, anteing up. The $1 trillion is just the ante to get into the game of actual infrastructure building. So Bernie said, 1 trillion, 13 million jobs, fine. Do that. Do it in 1 year and get the money from the Federal Reserve. Force the Federal Reserve to stop serving only the bankers, right? As you always say, right? The bankers, the 1% Wall Street. Not just for Wall Street, but it's got to be for the benefit of the entire economy. On unemployment, and you'll cut them off at the knees. And then the question of the federal budget. Well, we know Wall Street pays no taxes. We want Wall Street to pay a 1% Wall Street sales tax on turnover, buying and selling. And out of that money, you can do these things, the free college, the Medicare for all, save the social safety net. Half of it goes to the states. They do, they are able to rehire the police, the firemen, the teachers, and the other essential workers. So there's all that. And it was actually within this that we would look at 10 million jobs for people who are in the inner city, right? Essentially black and Hispanic inner city youth, plus white, poor white Appalachian rural people, and bring them into the labor force, right? Into the labor force for the first time, or rehabilitate them back in. Those are 10 million jobs. A lot of them could be summer jobs, other kinds of jobs. These are not primarily permanent careers, but they're a way to get you into the workforce. Again, the Marion Barry program, right? Former, the late D.C. Mayor Marion Barry, whose lasting achievement was to give so many people who otherwise might never have had a job, get them into the labor force, teach them the thrill of a paycheck, right? Show them in practice what it means to work in a job. So this is what I think Bernie should demand. First of all, make a public commitment in detail that there will be no regime change, no color revolution, no military attacks without a declaration of war by the Congress first, and that the United States, essentially, under the Kellogg-Briand Pact, I guess, has already said that war is not an admissible instrument of national policy. Then the 1% Wall Street sales tax, restore government employment, restore the social safety net, 10 million new jobs, entry-level jobs in some cases, or returning to the workforce, and pay, that's going to have to be paid for on the federal budget. And then establish this principle that the Federal Reserve is going to refinance all existing student loans at 0% and maturities of 40 to 50 years as needed. That's about $1.5 trillion. And then if Bernie wants to go with a $1 trillion initial tranche, an ante for openers, and he gets 13 million jobs out of that, do that. Do that in 1 year. That would be a beginning, with the idea that you're going to get that up to $5 trillion. But in terms of a deal, what Hillary Clinton has to pledge to accept, no war, 1% Wall Street sales tax, and make the Federal Reserve meet the needs of the entire American economy and not just her friends on Wall Street. And if, as is quite likely, she says, no, I want my free hand to wage war because otherwise I'm afraid to be a weak woman, well, then you make that public and let the public know and see who backs down. So that's certainly a terrible situation. Don't blame me. If Bernie had been out there in October attacking on the emails, the Goldman Sachs speeches, and Hillary's demand for the attack on Libya, Bernie would be the presumptive winner today. He chose not to do that. So learn one thing. Get somebody who fights. See you next week on World Crisis Radio.